Welcome to Let's Talk, brought to you live by the National Indigenous Radio Service, the only opportunity offered to the broader community to be informed on the issues and current affairs from a First Nations perspective. This is Bo Spearham with Let's Talk.
Good morning and welcome to Let's Talk. Before I go on any further, I would like to acknowledge the traditional owners on whose land we are broadcasting from. I also would like to pay my respects to our elders and also our elders of more recent arrival. And a good morning to everybody around the continent that is taking our program via the National Indigenous Radio Service NIRS and also listening via our app at 98.9FM or our website at 98.9FM.com.au, connecting us to everybody around the world as well. And a big shout out to all those mob that are tuning in so early as well, especially on the western part of the country. On the program with me, pretty much for the entirety of this week, I've been yarning with some of the mob that has been involved in the NACHO annual members conference, the NACHO's members conference and AGM that has been going for the last few days. And Tuesday, actually, to kick it off, I had a chat with Wendy, who was a part of the Aboriginal Torres Strait Islander Youth Health Conference, and the theme of the conference this year is Future Leaders of Tomorrow. My guest on the program this morning is First Nations as well, but not from here, from Canada, Nadine. How are you going?
I'm doing great. Thanks, Bo.
That's all good. Thanks for making some time this morning as well to have a chat with us.
Oh, my pleasure, absolutely.
And just before we start, could I get you to tell us your name, your mob, and where you're from? Because that's something we, I'm sure, is the same with you mob back home as well. When you meet other First Nations people from the same country, you always explain your connection to your family and also your country.
Absolutely. First of all, I love how you call it the mob. My daughter and I are enjoying Australia, and one of the things we are enjoying are the different terms. So I did caution her that the mob is a very affectionate term and certainly not the mob we think of in North America.
Oh, okay, yep. Yeah.
I love it. So my name is Nadine Carone, and I'm from the Sagamok First Nation, which is up in northern Ontario. Mm-hmm. From across the world, the closest city in Canada that would relate to would be Toronto, but we're a long way from Toronto in Ontario. But currently I'm living up in northern British Columbia, which is the most westerly province in Canada.
Yep. Awesome. And you were one of the keynote speakers. I saw some of your talk briefly yesterday as I was dropping some gear off to some of our co-workers that was doing some filming at the NACHO conference. You were one of the key speakers. What was, your talk regarding?
Well, it was an honor to really even be in that room. The presence that you just feel with the NACHO members, I truly will never forget it. And so when I was asked to give the keynote address, I was working with Julian Fitzgerald and, of course, Wendy, and finding out a little bit more about the organization. And it's quite diverse. And so I was trying to figure out, you know, it's not a bunch of doctors or healthcare providers. It's not just healthcare administrators. It's not only people that are providing medical care. It's not just public servants. It's also community members, people on the front line. So I was trying to think of a way to create a dialogue that would really, I was hoping in some way, fit with what would resonate with everyone in the room. Mm-hmm. And so I shared a Canadian perspective and just mine, you know, just as a personal perspective, things over the years that I've reflected on. And one of them is how we tackle the disparities and the gaps between health status, access and utilization of health services, the determinants of health upstream from the healthcare system, and even access to health research and the funding and the resources and the capacity that goes into that. And my message was basically a way to reconsider how we even acknowledge those disparities and how, as Indigenous peoples or Aboriginals in Australia, how maybe we should be careful what we ask for. The dialogue is often closing the gaps or decreasing the disparities, and I really focused on the fact that I think, really, well, I know in Canada that we're so much more capable than that. The resilience and self-determination and the path that we're on in Canada, that I think we should be aiming to optimize our our health status. I don't think we should be limited by the health status of the rest of Canadians. I think that we can lead the way and show how we can be healthier and we can be more proactive. We can do preventative medicine better. We can advocate for our youth better. There's so many things that we can do that I think I see a future where if we ask not just to be equal, but to just be unlimited in what we can accomplish, that I think that may be a different way to frame the conversation and how we communicate with entities such as our governments, funding agencies. The people that right now, especially in Canada, are primarily non-Indigenous and that we're not at the table as much, but I think we can get them to listen if we continue to show that we have that, we have the capacity and we have the desire to build that capacity.
Definitely. And I guess, you know, all around the world as well, like you're saying, you know, I guess it's sort of like that lens that we're sort of seen by is that, you know, there's only so much that we can do for ourselves. So that's sort of the capacity that I guess, you know, broader community want to sort of have us limited to. But like you're saying, yeah, you know, like we can sort of lead that way with health or with any other sort of sector or sort of, you know, space that, you know, like we're put to. And considering that, you know, for so long, you know, as Indigenous peoples, like we sort of led, you know, the way in terms of how we live, not just with ourselves, but also, you know, the environment around us as well.
Exactly. I mean, even, you know, there's been some studies, not that I've been involved with, but I've certainly enjoyed reading the publications from them in Canada. When you even just return to a traditional diet, go back to the hunting and gathering, go back to what our elders and our generations that before us did, that actually has incredible impact on the manifestations of something like diabetes. In fact, perhaps even stronger than the traditional insulin and the glucometer readings. And so it's fascinating when you kind of look at it and you go, we actually had the answers before we developed the problems. And the problems, actually, you know, we know that a lot of this is embedded in colonization and the impacts of federal policies. And I think we need to just remember that we've been there before. I think we just need to get back to a lot of what we used to have, and hang on to that and build it and believe in it.
Definitely. And I guess, you know, how do you do that? You know, how do you sort of implement that into sort of like a Western frame? And I guess, you know, that's something I guess health professionals have been sort of banging their head on. Indigenous health professionals at that as well, you know, I'm sure have been banging their heads, you know, on that door for quite some time now.
That's a million-dollar question, isn't it? You know what? I'm a healthcare an Indigenous healthcare provider, and I'm actually I'm a surgeon. It's like, you know, it's the of all the Western paradigms, perhaps the most concrete. It's sort of like, I think one of the things is in terms of what I try to do is I'm on the inside of that Western system. And so I think it's my responsibility and those that that I'm working with that have that Indigenous perspective to create an environment in that Western paradigm that actually is culturally safe, that carries with it cultural humility, and so that it becomes a place that our people feel like they can, when they need it, actually access the resources and have that whole capacity or that whole avenue open to them. I think it's also my responsibility to recognize that even though I've gone to school for, I don't know, like 15, 17 years after high school, that that when it comes to those elements that I think we really need to hold on to, ceremony, really connection to culture, that connectivity to land, the learning our language, that it's my elders and my grandparents, my parents that provide that, and making sure that you respect what you don't know and what you need to learn and what you need to build, and you give space to those people. So if I have an elder that comes into my office, I think it's really important to not just ask what medication he or she is on, with the thought that they think I'm asking about a prescription medication that their GP gave them. But I also want to know, like, what traditional medicines are they on? Do they use ceremony? And to open that dialogue so you could see this light go on where they realize, you know what? This doctor in the hospital actually cares what else I'm doing. And I care because I actually think that they have a better chance of surviving this cancer or this infection or this entity because they have two ways to deal with it. The, you know, the traditional culture, ceremony, and medicine. And I say, you're so lucky. I actually see people that don't even have anything besides a prescription. Can you imagine that? And to have that dialogue and to have that conversation and then to learn from my patients, because in Canada, of course, we have, like, in the Northern Health Authority, which is the area that I work in British Columbia, there's like over 50 different distinct First Nations. And so, you know, there's lots of overlap in the ceremony and traditional medicines, but there's lots of differences. I learned so much from my patients. I can't even believe that. You know, they should be acknowledged for the time that they take to teach me what they know and what they do and why they do it. It's just incredible.
Is it, like, what we're just talking about now, is there much sort of recognition for sort of that type of healing, but then also approach to traditional medicines back home for your mob? Like, yeah, you know, like, I guess how, you know, like you said, you know, eating traditional food sort of, you know, reduces the risk of things like diabetes. But then also, I think, even walking on country and being on country, you know, and having, you know, like, sort of, you know, like a natural de-stress sort of situation when you're being back on country. Like, are those things sort of recognized or acknowledged back home as sort of being ways of, you know, I guess medically, you know, healing healing people back home?
You know, they're certainly recognized in the community, you know, but when, you know, the further you move from community into, say, the health clinic in the community, to the hospital down the road, to the metropolitan center that is a 2-hour flight, I think you get less and less connected to that. And you move almost like, you can almost think of it as a spectrum, and then they, you know, these patients and their family, and by extension their community, feel like they're really, that they have to choose between one system or the other. And I think that's where it's our responsibility as leaders within healthcare, whether it's a healthcare professional or someone in health policy or someone in the government, someone in health administration, to really recognize that the system has no right to impose its beliefs on another. Because it's funny, like, you go to these big metropolitan centers, and they seem to believe that if you, like, do yoga at lunch, that it's going to be healthier. And then all of a sudden, you talk about walking on country, and and they're like, oh, how can that be helpful?
Well, actually,
it's so amazing. Yeah. Like, if you're wearing, like, the brand name, like, Lululemon yoga, that you must be really healthy. If you're walking in moccasins through the forest, you know, that can't really be helpful. Like, it's crazy how Western, the Western paradigm is, I don't know, it almost, are they even intimidated by what we do and why we do it? Do I believe in it? Absolutely.
Yes,
and again, I can't stress enough that's what I learned from people who really take the time to pass that on to me, my mom and my community.
Definitely. Just one thing on what you were saying before about, like, the comparisons. I don't know if it's a thing over there, but I think it's starting to become, like, a phenomenon here of doing yoga with goats. There's Facebook online groups of people, you know, sharing, like meditating and yoga, doing yoga, you know, like, with baby goats next to them, which, I guess, you know, if that's their thing, that's their thing. Have you been over here before?
Have I been to Australia? I have. Always for short stints. Pretty much always for something related to health policy, health research. But I'm really enjoying this trip over to Brisbane.
Next question was, like, and obviously, you know, working within this space, and, you know, you would know sort of, I guess, the health statistics of Aboriginal people here and how I'm guessing they are similar back home.
Yeah, in terms of I don't know the specifics, but I do know when I was talking yesterday to this incredible group of people that are so wise, on the ground, passionate about this area, then when I was referring to disparities, they were just, you know, very solemnly just nodding their heads as if, you know, someone said it, I think, really perfectly after the talk. A lady came up and said, you know what, if you didn't have an accent and we were just listening to your talk, it was as if you were from Australia.
Yeah.
You know, in terms of the disparities, the frustrations, the racism, the biases, the you know, the fight for funding, the you know, getting your voice heard, the paucity of Indigenous healthcare providers, the need to build that, like it was I loved how she said it. One, because I love being in a place where I have an accent, and two, because it really was a perfect way to sort of summarize that that we have these unfortunate parallels. I think we have a lot of parallels between our countries, and ones that we can be proud of, but these, of course, are the opposite side of the coin, where I think we're very similar and both struggling for the same outcome.
Definitely. And you said earlier, off air, when we were talking, when I brought you in, you were here with your daughter as well. How was the trip, you know, sort of being with her over this way? Is she sort of realizing the similarities as well back from back home?
It's been a great trip with her. I think it's important that our youth learn, and so she's learning a lot on this trip. I think being at the conference itself, seeing the similarities, hearing what people are saying. Like, I think she was even with me when that wonderful, beautiful elder came up and said that to me about the accent and being so similar. But I think she's also noticing, like, I have to just say, this natural organization. I just said to her, I said, just look at these people that work together. Look at what they're doing. I don't think we have anything remotely similar in Canada. And I said, could you imagine? Like, I'm just thinking of the people that we were with even last night after, you know, the chaos of the actual conference slowed down and there was a time for them to breathe, and just talking to these members of NATCHO that are behind the scenes pulling this all together. And I said, what, could you imagine going into work and working with these people? It would be so uplifting to just spend a week with them and just be in the office, and they bring a passion, but they bring this positivity that radiates. Even when the conversation's hard and we're talking about such sad things, the energy in the room. I just feel so fortunate to be a part of it.
And the only reason why I brought that up is because on Tuesday was the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Health Youth Conference. I believe the first of its kind at NATCHO, and I think
it was.
I think it's something they want to continue as well. You know, I think it was 75 young people, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people from all around Australia, you know, coming to discuss health and public policy issues affecting young people, I spent a bit of the day there with them, listening in and having a yarn to some of the people. A cousin of mine actually was there from New South Wales, so I got to catch up with him, which was good. But yeah, you know, obviously, like how important is it to sort of have, I guess, you know, sort of this underarching sort of group of young people ready to step up, and as well, it's so important that we have, you know, Indigenous peoples within this space, you know, who come from, I guess, you know, a culturally sounded environment when it comes to, you know, understanding the, I guess, you know, what sort of drives our people, like the issues behind our people as well. How important is it for young people to sort of get ready to step into this role? Because I guess at times, you know, being in this position can be very daunting as well.
Yes. I think it's critical, absolutely critical. And I mean, I see it in the questions that my daughter asks, and she's only 12. But you can see their thinking, and you can see that they have a critical lens that they put on things, particularly when it's almost as if, what I think of is as children get older and move into youth, into teenagers and beyond, we start to put these filters on. And as a child, you know, you just need to go to a playground and watch a bunch of three-year-olds. They, when they have a question, they just ask. There's no filter. There's no one that tells them that's inappropriate, that's politically incorrect, that's very sensitive, that's a hard question to answer. They just ask anything from why is the sky blue? Why are those two ladies holding their hands? You know, what's wrong with that man's, you know, leg? They just ask, and it's beautiful because they just want to know. They're not judging. They just want to know. And as we get older, we stop asking questions. And I think when we capture a venue where youth can ask questions, when they can be surrounded by other youth that want the answers to these questions, and they want to be part of the solutions, I think we start really, we say it, and it sounds cliche, but building leaders of tomorrow. But particularly, I think it's even more important and more vital for Indigenous youth, partly because that's where our demographic is. So very different than, you know, in North America, we call it the silver tsunami. Because our population is just aging, and we're about to hit like a wall of a majority of the population just being like over the age of 60. Now, but if you take our Indigenous groups, you'll see that the population demographics are much different, and so we have way more youth under the age of 25 or 18. Doesn't even matter on the statistic. We just have more youth, and so we have this. We have this youth tsunami that's coming forward that's going to take our wishes, our expectations, our hopes of what we are doing now, and they're going to ideally take the optimism that people in this room at NACHO are showing and saying, this is what we could do, this is why we're fighting, this is why we need it, and then also building that capacity so when they step down, there's going to be this mass of youth coming through that have been part of the dialogue, and they're going to feel like they own these questions and own these solutions and own the responsibility to get to those endpoints because they've been part of the journey. But to expect them to join at the end of, and join on when they're not part of any of these dialogues ahead of time, they will. Because I did, but boy, would it have been helpful if as a young teenager, I was brought into these kind of conversations. I think I think it's the difference between a running start at the beginning of a 100 meters versus being in the blocks. You just you're gonna just get to where you want to be easier, faster, and more likely to succeed.
Definitely. Like, for the most of the program, you know, we've been, you know, just sort of breaking up on the reasons why you're here. You know, what you're talking about at the conference, you know, some of the, I guess, similarities between Indigenous peoples, you know, Aboriginal people here, and then also, you know, your mob back home. What was your driving force behind wanting to sort of to be a surgeon, but then also to be in this field as well, to be an Indigenous doctor?
Yeah, you know what? It's interesting. So first of all, no family influence in the sense that there was no one in my family that was in medicine or any of the healthcare professions. But all family in the sense that, particularly my parents just really believed in the value of education. And so I didn't know I wanted to be a doctor in elementary school or high school, but I did know that education was important, and I actually didn't have an option. Education was important. So succeeding in high school academically was non-negotiable in my parents' eyes, and they gave me the support, but also the guiding force to make me realize that, which I can never thank them enough. My mom was a residential school survivor and was the first on her reserve in her mob to graduate from a residential school, which was which I can't even imagine, because obviously that's not just the graduating from high school that we talk about today. Mm. And I know the challenges both in Australia and in Canada with respect
I'll just, like, just for our listeners as well, could you sort of explain what residential schools are?
Sure, yeah. So residential schools were federal government policy for basically assimilation. Mm. And basically, it was, and I know there's similar history in the United States and in Australia, and but it was mandatory for First Nations, First Nations Inuit children to be brought into these residential schools, which were run or basically put up by the federal government, often run completely by the churches, mm-hmm. Anglican, Catholic, and basically they were boarding schools for the most, you know, where the children were taken from their parents without consent and brought to these boarding schools, often hundreds and hundreds of kilometers away from home, and they were schools. But from what we have learned, looking back at our history, they were schools, but also a lot of sort of labor for the children to do, as opposed to the school that we think of that my daughter's going to, for example, where when she goes, she sits and she learns and has classes all day long. This was very different. And of course, then the history has come out about the emotional and physical and sexual abuse that was an egregious part of our history that we're healing from and facing head on in Canada now. And so my mom went to a residential school, and the terminology we use in Canada is she's a residential school survivor. But for my mom to go through a school that was a residential school and affiliated with those types of reputations, for her to still say education is so valuable and I got an education from my residential school, for her to recognize that despite all of that, that she took an education from that and there was good in that education. She doesn't mention the other parts of it, but there was good in the education. Obviously, that was just so, so important to my parents and what they passed on.
Definitely. Because over here, we call them boarding schools.
Right, yeah.
Dormitories. They were just dormitories. And
okay.
And there's a really famous song from an uncle here, Uncle Archie Roach, called Took the Children Away. And I remember one time I was just on YouTube looking to play it and watch the film clip. And somebody from over your way made a film clip, and it just had like a lot of the schools, a lot of the residential schools that the young First Nations people were taken to as well.
Yes. And you know what? Last time I was in Brisbane was for the World Indigenous Cancer Conference, and Archie Roach was there, he was singing some songs. No one in the room warned me when he began that song. Everyone obviously knew the song, but I didn't know what it was about. And people were bringing me Kleenex, and my daughter was sitting on my knee, and that hit me like a load of bricks. That is one of the most powerful songs I have ever heard from a very, very powerful human being.
Definitely. Yeah. He's one of our treasures, Uncle Archie is.
Yeah.
So you got that support from your family. And then I guess, was it sort of always something in high school, or was that you wanted to sort of be?
No. And you know what? I wish it was, because it sounds like such a fairy tale story. but it wasn't. And I think it helps, because when I talk to kids and I say, you know what, I didn't know I wanted to be a doctor, I think it's actually very empowering to them, because then they realize, you know what, she looks like she's having a lot of fun being a doctor, and she didn't even know in high school that's what she wanted to do, let alone in elementary school. And so I actually, I'll admit it, I chose to go to university because, like I said, it was just so, so important to my parents, and they really supported me. But also, I played basketball. And so basketball was a love of mine, more than any other subject. And so I actually chose decided on which university to go to based on where I wanted to play basketball. And so I had an incredible coach at Simon Fraser University in Burnaby, British Columbia, which is just outside of Vancouver. And that university had an incredibly wonderful basketball program. And so I had the opportunity there, and they happened to have an incredibly strong kinesiology program. And that is the study of basically human movement, so physiology, anatomy. And so I loved it, and it fit well with me being an athlete. It was a lot of athletes took kinesiology because it made sense. You used your body, and you wanted to understand it. And here was an entire program where your job was to understand the human body. But it set me up to realize just how amazing the human body was. And so it was a combination of that. And then I just happened to, it's a long story, but the bottom line is I had an opportunity to spend a summer with a doctor. And someone had set that up for me because I didn't know if I wanted to go out into medicine or not, but I was coming to the end of my career at the undergrad and finishing up at Simon Fraser University. So I spent, I didn't know what kind of doctor they were going to hook me up with, but they ended up sort of hooking me up with a general surgeon. His name was Tom Edwards, and he was in Tennessee in the United States. And I ended up being set up to work with him for the summer. I was still in university in undergrad. And the very first day I got to Jackson, Tennessee, he was on call. His pager went off. He had to rush into the hospital. I hopped into his truck and off we went. And he did this emergency surgery for someone that was bleeding to death. And I remember somehow between the beginning of the surgery and the end of the surgery, I just said, this is it. This is what I want to do. I want to learn how to take my knowledge of the anatomy and physiology of the human body, use my hands, and figure out how I can have a positive impact one by one on patients that trust me and that I get to meet. And so it was amazing. It was like a real single moment in time where I just made this lifetime decision. And I remember it very, very clearly.
Yeah. And is there, because you said you're a surgeon as well, is there many other Indigenous surgeons back home?
There are not a lot, but we're certainly building up, increasing the number of Indigenous healthcare providers overall. And there are a few Indigenous surgeons in British Columbia, a combination between Métis and First Nations in BC. I think for the most part, we're certainly working at the University of British Columbia. We've been working on increasing the number of Indigenous graduates from medical school. And at the UBC Center for Excellence in Indigenous Health that we started about, well, almost 5 years ago now, we are working to really push all the different health units, whether it's nursing, physiotherapy, kinesiology, dentistry, pharmacy, we're figuring out how can we work with them, how can we support students, high school students, undergraduate, university students, to get into these programs, to find a career that they love, to pursue something that they've dreamed of, to show them options that they didn't know they had, and really increase the number of Indigenous healthcare professionals across the board, whether it's specialists or family doctors or allied healthcare professionals. I think it's going to be really important that we really increase those numbers so that our people can walk into a hospital or a health clinic and see another Indigenous person there that I think will create an environment that has that cultural safety and humility. And then in the meantime, at UBC, at our Center for Excellence in Indigenous Health, we're also working on mandatory education for anyone who wants to be a healthcare professional in any field of any background to do cultural safety and humility training through our center. And that's a real goal of ours, because I think addressing that entity of like having choices for someone who's, say, First Nations in British Columbia, mm-hmm. to have the option to pursue knowledge holders, knowledge keepers in their community with respect to traditional medicines and ceremony, but also to walk into a Western system and feel comfortable that they're going to be respected and they're going to be heard and they're going to be treated and cared for in the Western paradigm.
I don't know if it is the same back there, but how important is it to sort of, I guess, educate non-Indigenous peoples about sort of, how to sort of approach Indigenous patients? Because I guess for the most part over here as well, you know, I think a lot of our mobs sort of get turned off of going to sort of health professionals because of, whether it's indirect or not, you know, like sort of racism that they sort of get in the health profession as well. And then also, you know, a lot of these doctors have sort of these stereotypes, you know, which, you know, sometimes leads to a lot of our peoples, whether it's here or back over your way, dying or, you know, still not sort of reaching that, you know, sort of medical assistance that they need.
Right, right. I am, in terms of your question, like, how important is it? I think it's mandatory. I think a few years ago in Canada, if you said that a program like a medical school or a nursing program or a pharmacy department, if they were teaching their trainees about the history of Indigenous people in Canada, about the cultural differences, about ways to approach, you know, an Indigenous patient to account for some of these cultural differences and to ensure that they're respected and there's that space. I think a few years ago that would have been thought of as very open-minded, very laudable, they would have been really congratulated for this proactive approach. I think in Canada we're getting to the point, and certainly the Center for Excellence in Indigenous Health is really pushing for this, that it's mandatory. Mm. It's not exceptional. It's a baseline. It's not an incredible vision. It's actually a starting point. We're really trying to change the dialogue so that this, if you deserve to be a healthcare provider in Canada, my viewpoint is that you better know the history of Canada. And definitely, that doesn't just mean Olympic gold medals, maple syrup, and poutine. That, that means getting into the trenches and realizing that there is a history of a population within Canada, meaning our three distinct and constitutionally recognized Indigenous populations in Canada, that as a Canadian healthcare provider, you are expected to know and you are expected to respect, and then you have the right to train and to work in Canada. You have to have your medical degree, or you have to get into nursing school, and you need to know your pharmacy curriculum to be a doctor or a nurse or a pharmacist, but that's not good enough in my mind. And at the Center for Excellence in Indigenous Health, we're trying to change the dialogue so it's not good for anybody in British Columbia, and then hopefully lead the way so that that can be transported across Canada. And I don't know what's happening in Australia, but when I brought up cultural safety and cultural humility in the audience, people were nodding their heads. And then I said, you know, I'm talking to a group of people that understand this, so let's just call it what it is. We're aiming for cultural safety and humility, but yes, we're trying to strip the racism out of the system. We're trying to address stereotypes and bias. We're trying to so you can look at it, cultural safety and humility is a wonderful, politically safe way to say this is what we're training our students in the healthcare profession. But I think Indigenous people in Canada, and it sounds like in Australia as well, are much more willing to just say, you know, the racism has to stop.
No, definitely. I just want to say a big thanks as well for joining us on the program this morning as well. I think you all might have had a big night last night. What's your go-to karaoke song?
Oh, you know what? I had a blast. So having never done karaoke before, can now leave, and when I board the plane on Sunday morning, I can say that I have now done karaoke, much to the shock of my daughter. I saw the other side of Nacho in terms of just how much fun they can have. And it's funny, you know, I've never done karaoke, but every song that was up there, well, I shouldn't say every song, most songs that were up there, I was like, that would have been a great song to sing. And then, of course, there were some that were so popular, the entire audience started singing with the people on the stage. And I'm like, I haven't heard this song. And then they started explaining, oh, this is, you know, you haven't heard this. And then they were explaining the Australian, the background to the Australian artist or the song. And so I got some a different type of culture in terms of finding out who the stars are in the folk songs over here.
Definitely. But yeah, big thanks for joining us on the program. And if you ever want to come over to the station while you're here, would love to get yourself and your daughter over here to sort of give you a tour of the station and introduce you to some of the other radio announcers and some of the other workers, staff members here at the station as well.
Oh, that would be great, Bo. That would be great. I think I know that Julian has a way to get a hold of you. So Julian Fitzgerald, who was one that somehow got me on the him and Wendy well, somehow got me on the plane. And I will be forever grateful to them, to Nacho, and to the Aboriginals in Australia that were in that room yesterday. I feel so honored to be part of this.
Definitely. And I guess there's a credit to the work that you're doing and the work that your mob have been doing back home, that sort of cements, the legacy for Indigenous medicine around the world as well, that, we all continue to sort of
I think we're all moving in the same direction.
That's a
big team, and I think we're growing.
But no, big thank you, and hopefully I'll get on to Jules and Wendy to see if they can bring you over for a chat and a cup or something.
Okay, sounds wonderful. Alrighty, well, take care.
Likewise. Thank you.
Thanks, Bo.
And that was my guest, Nadine from Nacho. She was one of the key speakers at the conference yesterday morning, and she's a First Nations woman from Canada. She's a surgeon, and you can catch the repeat of this conversation 7 p.m. tonight on 98.9 FM, or you can go to our website at 98.9fm.com.au for the repeat. And you've been listening to Let's Talk here on 98.9 FM. Also, there's a few community events that are coming up. The community Kibingai Youth and Family Development Community Art Exhibition is on Friday, the 23rd of November. Where? It's Kibingai Youth Development at 425 Zilmia Road, Zilmia, 4034. It's the Old Bakery, and that's from 6:30 p.m. to 9:30 p.m. If you'd like to go and be a part of it, call 07-3156-4800. That's 07-3156-4800. There'll be nibblies and some drinks. It's a community event, so there won't be any alcoholic drinks for anybody, but it's a good initiative to be a part of. Please come along and help celebrate the amazing work by some of the local artists on the north side. And it's been a really good week this week on Let's Talk. It's been good to be back and doing Let's Talk, but then also talking to the Deadly Mob and the Deadly Health Professionals that have been a part of the Nacho annual members conference. It's always deadly to see our mob shining and doing good things in the community as well. Also, this month is the Indigenous Football Championships in Logan, from the 8th to the 10th. Get on Facebook and check that out as well. The Indigenous Football Championships in Logan. Hit up Brother Ramon Close because he's heading that up. And there's some good teams, men's, women's, and juniors maybe, I think. But it's been a pleasure speaking with all you mob here on Let's Talk.